Chapter 5. Regards to the Navy. Mitchell received a hero's welcome when he arrived back home. Newspapers throughout the world doted on his wartime exploits. He emerged from the conflict with name recognition usually reserved for heads of state. The buoyant and jubilant Brigadier General Billy Mitchell, who proudly stepped off the Aquitania in New York, fully expected to receive command of the Army Air Service, now well-funded with its $650 million wartime appropriation and staffed with 170,000 officers and men. Mitchell made extensive plans on his ocean voyage from France. The war convinced him aircraft would be the decisive military weapon of the future. With the resources now available, he looked forward to building a unified air command that would make the United States invincible. He would lead the greatest military air power on Earth. Through training programs and robust civil and commercial development, aviation would take its rightful position of dominance over the Army and the Navy. Or so he thought. His dream was short-lived. Despite Mitchell's objections, General Minor, a non-flyer, was put in charge of the Army Air Service, with Mitchell relegated to his assistant. Officers and men were being discharged in huge numbers, and orders for undelivered aircraft and engines were being canceled. The years following the war were filled with disappointments for Mitchell. His long absences and preoccupation with the air service had left his relations with his wife and child in tatters. His frequent accusations of incompetency against those who disagreed with his opinions, which were most of the non-flying officers, created many enemies. Enthusiastic support came only from fellow airmen, and their number had been reduced from 20,000 to fewer than 1,300. As 1919 began. With his dreams turned into nightmares, Mitchell's frustration grew as his efforts redoubled. The air service was being dismantled before it could prove its value. He believed he had a mission to save it. An assistant to General Minor, Mitchell prepared reports concluding that aircraft could sink surface ships, a view challenged by the Navy as unsubstantiated and a gross exaggeration of air power. During the war, only one obscure Greek aircraft had actually dropped bombs on a surface ship, causing minor damage, certainly a long way from sinking the ship. Mitchell insisted that military prudence demanded he have the opportunity to demonstrate his theory. In April 1919, in order to blunt Mitchell's flurry of written reports and memos, Admiral Winterhalter agreed to a meeting at which Mitchell could present his case to 14 naval air officers. The morning meetings went very well. Mitchell's views of air power seemed to complement the Navy's plans for future expansion of naval aviation. Lunch was a cordial affair with General Minor, relieved that his assistant had not, after all, added to the simmering competition and turf warfare that had characterized Army and Navy relationships since the services began. The afternoon meetings proved otherwise. Mitchell went into the details of his vision of future U.S. military defense. He dismissed naval aircraft, slow and ponderous, encumbered by bulky pontoons or clumsy amphibian designs, as useless. Needed were the sleek, aerodynamic, speedy Army airplanes which would quickly dispatch any opposing aircraft. Furthermore, only land-based bombers could lift the heavy bomb loads against which sea or land defenses would be completely helpless. As usual, Mitchell came prepared with convincing facts and figures. In 3 years of gunnery practice, land-based guns struck targets towed by planes only 1 in 10,000 shots, while guns fired from the heaving deck of a ship were even less successful. For the cost of one battleship, 1,000 aircraft could be built and perform 100 times more effectively. Mitchell concluded that surface ships were obsolete and that an independent navy must be subjugated to a unified defense command under the supremacy of land-based air power. A stony silence followed his presentation. The naval officers couldn't believe what they were hearing. General Manohr sank down in his chair as if to slide, unnoticed, under the table. Admiral Winterhalter slowly rose and, in icy tones, thanked the Army for its presentation and advised them the meeting was over. The naval delegation filed out of the room in silence. In their minds, Mitchell had transitioned from a minor annoyance to a mortal enemy. He would never again be invited to speak before their general board. Manohr sat slumped in his chair, too shocked to rise until assisted by Mitchell. Mitchell left more resolved than ever to prove, through a bombing demonstration, that everything he had just said was not only true, but militarily inevitable.